If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
As a plant-based cheese company, Daiya has never talked about beef in an ad before, because someone somewhere once had a beef with saying beef and plant-based together. So putting a slice of Daiya cheese on a beef burger, not okay. Well, our delicious melty cheese has a beef with your beef about beef, because any step towards plant-forward eating is a step in the right direction. Daiya, 100% plant-based, even if you're not. Now made with Daiya Oat Cream Blend.
Hi there, and welcome to the BBC History Magazine podcast. I'm Dave Musgrove, the editor of the magazine, and I'm joined by our deputy editor, Sue Wingrove. Hi, Sue.
Hello.
And our staff writer, Rob Atter.
Hi, hello,
Rob.
Dave.
Very good. Now, Christmas is coming, of course, so we'll be celebrating by pulling a few crackers during the course of this podcast. But before we go on, let me just tell you about an extra podcast that we'll be having from the BBC History Magazine team this month. We're going to be releasing it on the 10th of December, and it's going to be our special History Pub Quiz podcast. So please do download that and test your history knowledge with your friends and family over the festive break. Now, our big interviews this month are with Julian Humphreys and Max Hastings. Julian has written the cover feature on the December issue, all about the art of siege warfare, so I'll be chatting to him in a moment. But Rob has been talking to Max Hastings. So Rob, what will Max be telling us about?
Well, Max, this month's podcast, is going to be talking quite a lot about Australia in the Second World War and how the Australian war effort pretty much came to a halt in around 1943. And Churchill was begging the Australian government to help Britain's cause, and Australia said, no, we're keeping our troops at home, we're not joining in.
What's Max's views on all that?
Well, Max is pretty appalled by it, actually. He's very critical of the Australian government and of the Australian unions who were almost impeding the Allied war effort. But he also kind of sees where Australia was coming from, because a couple of years earlier, Britain had failed to protect the country when the Japanese were, you know, scything through Southeast Asia. And Australia was imperiled, and Britain was concentrating on Europe and wasn't really, Australian government didn't feel, wasn't really helping enough.
It's quite a controversial topic, isn't it?
It certainly is, yeah. And there's a lot of controversial topics in the Far Eastern War. We've got the atom bomb, you've got Japanese atrocities in the Far East, and a lot of that will be in the feature this month. So I think, but in the podcast too, Max makes it clear that it was a pretty unpleasant conflict.
Okay, well, that'll be interesting to listen to what Max has to say in a minute. Now, after those two interviews with Julian and Max, we've got a special recording from a tunnel deep inside the prehistoric Silbury Hill in Wiltshire, which is shortly to be filled in forever. Now, I was invited to take a tour of this archaeological wonder, and you'll be able to listen to the archaeologist who's been leading the work from that very tunnel deep inside the hill, and that'll be the last interview on this podcast. But before we get on to the interviews, let me have a chat with Sue. Now, Sue's in charge of our book review section, so she gets pretty much every history book that's published land on her desk. So I thought we'd have an end-of-year chat. So, Sue, what have been the biggest books of the year that you've seen then?
Well, we've had lots of big books of various different topics. A few that I'd pluck out of the ether. One, I think, would be Marcus Rediker's book, The Slave Ship, A Human History. Now, there's been a lot written about slavery this year. This takes a very personal look at life on the slave ships, which were obviously pretty gruesome places. It takes the sort of human angle, and it tries to use contemporary voices as much as possible. So we're sort of getting beyond the sort of factual, you know, this is what happened in the slave trade and wasn't it awful, to actually looking at the people who experienced it, from the slaves themselves to the sailors as well, on these sort of horrific, you know, cargo ships.
Sure. What other were the big books then?
What else have we got? Well, no year would be complete without a great big Second World War book.
Of course.
And this year we've got Saul Freelander's magisterial new work on Nazi Germany. The Years of Extermination, Nazi Germany and the Jews, 1939-45.
Didn't we? We had Dan Stone review that in the magazine.
Yeah, didn't we? He described it as a remarkable study, an outstanding book, and he reckons it's going to be required reading for years to come.
Okay,
so that's a pretty big book.
And I think you picked out one other book on the history of trains, didn't you? As another big book.
Yeah, we all like trains, some more than others. And Fire and Steam is written by Christian Wolmar. Now he's one of the nation's most passionate advocates of rail transport, and he's also a self-confessed former train spotter.
Right.
It's fascinating. It's accessible, and it's very interesting. And the only thing I can say really is, what did they do for the first 40 years before trains had toilets? If you read this book, you'll probably find out.
Yeah. Rob, what is the answer to that?
You shudder to think, really, don't you?
I can tell you the answer if you don't want to read the book. The answer is they had long delays between the train arriving at the station and the train leaving the station, because obviously the entire train load of people had to get off, find somewhere to go, and then hop back on again, all before the train departed the station.
Okay.
So that, in fact, is why the trains ran on time in the past, because they had great big long periods of time in which to arrive and depart.
I think a station manager can't be much fun in those days.
Now, Sue, every year there's themes in what's published. So what have been the big themes of 2007?
Okay, several big themes, mainly based on anniversaries, because we all love an anniversary.
Mm.
Probably the biggest anniversary was 1807, was the abolition of the slave trade on British ships. So lots of books coming out to commemorate that, written from all sorts of different angles. Mm. We had James Walvin's The Trader, The Owner and the Slave, looked at the trade through the eyes of those three types of individuals. And it's a sort of strong, gripping narrative, and explores, you know, what it was like for people on all the different sides of the slave issue.
Mm.
Now, Marika Sherwood explored a different angle in her book After Abolition, which examines Britain's involvement in the illegal slave trade after 1807. She points out that Britain carried on investing and trading in slave-produced goods, most notably cotton, which, of course, was you know, big raw product in Victorian Britain. So, yeah, that's quite an interesting angle.
Yeah, I mean, Marika's always been very vociferous on the untold aspects of the British slave trade, so I'm sure she had a lot of interesting things to say.
She had a lot to say. It was a passionate and provocative book written with anger, as our reviewer said.
Yeah.
Now, one more on that topic was Abolition by Richard Reddy, who writes from what he calls a Black Atlantic Caribbean Christian perspective.
Mm.
And in spite of being a Christian, he doesn't shrink from drawing attention to the church's role in the exploitation of Africans at that time.
Well, so that is a very hot topic.
Any more themes?
Yeah, let's have one more theme.
One more theme. Now, interestingly, the Second World War, seen from a German perspective, is something that seems to be happening more and more in this country. We've had lots of studies of the Second World War, but up to now we haven't really heard much from the German side.
Mm.
And this year it's all changing a bit. German historian Heinrich August Winkler's History of Pre-Nazi Germany is called Germany, The Long Road West. And he tries to explain where some of the Nazi ideals come from. And he goes back even to the medieval period to explain the sort of German psyche and how Nazism took such a hold on the country. And then we've got Hitler's Home Front by Jill Stevenson, which is a long overdue history of the rural reality of Nazi Germany. In 1933, Germany was quite a rural country. I mean, a third of the country, you know, a third of the people lived in the country. And most of them hadn't even been to the cinema, let alone a Nazi rally.
Mm.
Different view to the sort of pre-war Germany that we normally hear about.
Yeah. And then, of course, we had that big book, Jörg Friedrich's The Fire, all about the bombing of Germany, didn't we?
Yeah,
that made a big impact, didn't it?
Yes, this translation of a book that came out in Germany in 2002 looks at one of the largest bombing campaigns in military history, when 2 million tons of bombs were dropped on Germany.
Yeah.
And, of course, many of them fell on civilian, you know, subjects. Our reviewer called it a fascinating, groundbreaking and thought-provoking book. But it's, I have to say, it's no easy read. It's got some shocking details about the firestorms.
No, it was fearsomely depressing, actually, when I read it. Ream upon ream of, well, basically shocking statistics about how bad the bombing was. But it's information that we didn't actually know about. So, quite an important book.
I mean, German historians have sort of feared to approach this because to show sort of Germans as victims was really against the kind of, you know, zeitgeist, really. I mean, you just didn't used to do that sort of thing. But it's happening more and more. And another book along those lines is Charles McDonough's book, After the Reich, From the Liberation of Vienna to the Berlin Airlift, which again tells of the suffering that the German people endured in the aftermath of the war. As the war was closing, apparently there was a saying in Germany, enjoy the war, the peace will be terrible. And it was, there was absolute chaos. There were no food, terrible, terrible things were happening as sort of people, you know, displaced people roamed the countryside trying to feed themselves. And it was just a really, really dark chapter. And no one's really written about it because Germans themselves have been reluctant to highlight their own suffering.
Okay, well, that's an interesting roundup of last year's books. Just to finish off, Sue, though, tell me what you're reading right now.
I'm reading a book which we highlighted in our November issue, and that's Orlando Figi's The Whisperers, which is Private Life in Stalin's Russia. In Russian, there are two words for the word whisperer. One means the whisperer who went to the authorities and sneaked on someone, and the other means the whisperer who sort of kept quiet so that they wouldn't become, you know, wouldn't get betrayed or overheard, perhaps even by their own children. And it really evokes quite strongly this sort of, you know, sort of paranoid feeling that there was in Stalin's Russia. But what's great about this book is that it's written after a huge oral history project that was run after Russia opened up. Mm. And there are some, you know, incredible personal stories told, and it's really, really gripping. You know, you hear about collectivization and the terror, the gulags, the war, just terrible personal stories. It's really got the wow factor because as you read it, you're sort of going, every page you're going, my God, that really happened. And you're sort of disturbing someone to say, look, listen to this. Mm. It's great.
Sounds like sort of a bit Rob would like, but we won't let him talk about it because he'll just go on and on if we start talking about Russian history. Now, we haven't had a chance to get particularly festive yet, though, have we? So, Rob, I'd like you to pull the first cracker.
Yep, okay.
All right, let's hear the gag. What have you got there?
Well, we've actually got a paperclip, right, which
should be useful, a large isn't paperclip.
Very funny,
a
but
large pink paperclip.
Yeah, if you could get on with the joke, please.
Okay. Here we go, guys. Mm. Where should a dressmaker build her house? Any takers?
Well, no idea. No.
Come on, Sue, you must know this.
I've made a few dresses, but I can't get that.
Well, of course, on the outskirts.
Yeah, it's a very bad joke.
Mm. No one laughing. Mm.
Now, okay, well, we'll move on to the big interviews now, but just before we get started, let me just tell you a little bit about the magazine, which you can buy in all good news agents in the UK and in Borders in the US. It goes on sale on the last Tuesday of the month for just £3.60, but you can save money in a trip to the shops by subscribing. UK podcast listeners can subscribe today for just £16.20 every 6 issues, and that's a 25% saving on the cover price. You can order online at www.subscribeonline.co.uk/history magazine, quoting pod07, or you can call our hotline 0844 844 0250. So, on to the interviews. Firstly, we're going to go straight over to Julian Humphreys to find out just how one would go about capturing a castle.
Can you just tell me why you're interested in the subject of siege warfare?
Well, I think there's two reasons, really. First of all, you can actually go to the spot where the sieges took place. Hmm. On a lot of occasions, you can anyway. And so, you can go, for example, to Dover and stand in one of the tunnels that the French had built to undermine the walls. You can go to somewhere like Carisbrook on the Isle of Wight and stand on the spot where apparently one of the defending crossbowmen picked off the French commander. So you can really get in touch with the past in that way. But also, one of the things about sieges is that because they quite often dragged on for quite a long time, you do get some sort of sense of a relationship between the two sides. And you get letters exchanged, you get formal summonses to surrender turning into grudging respect, sometimes then developing into utter fury and exasperation. So you get a sort of sense of a relationship between the opposing commanders and the opposing soldiers. And I think that makes it quite a human thing to study.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So in your feature for the December issue of the magazine, you've told us the 10 ways to capture a castle. Now, just thinking about the early history of castles, we first see castles in Britain in the 11th century with the Mott and Bailey that were built by the Normans after 1066.
Yeah.
Now, a Mott and Bailey is essentially just a big mound with a wooden palisade. So I can think of one obvious way to attack that sort of fortification. So what happened with the early methods attacking them?
Yes, indeed. You only have to look at the Bay of Tapestry, in fact, to see a little blueprint on how to capture a wooden castle, at least force its surrender, set it to light.
Mm.
You can see in the Bayeux Tapestry it says Dinan in Brittany, in fact, and you can see two Norman knights, they put their shields down and they're holding up sort of burning firebrands and setting a light to the wooden walls above them. Meanwhile, one of the worried defenders is holding the keys of the castle out on a lance to surrender the castle. So obviously, right. Fire is the key way, I suppose, to capture, if you're going to have to attack a castle.
Yeah.
The only trouble with this is that you could end up with a load of charred ruins.
Yeah.
And more often than not, people who laid siege to castles wanted to capture them intact.
Sure.
For the obvious reason that they wanted to use them themselves afterwards. So if you could get a castle to surrender without having to damage it, so much the better.
Yeah, okay. That was one of the key methods of capturing a castle, wasn't it? Was basically to ask nicely.
Yes. Yeah. Diplomacy, I think, is better jaw-jaw than war-war, as Churchill said, I think. But the idea is somehow acquire a castle through marriage, through diplomatic means, as a ransom for something first. That is the key thing to do. But if that fails and it does come to conflict, yeah, ask nicely. Nicely in the sense of ask formally. There were set ways of doing this. Send a herald along to the castle in the later medieval period. Pay compliments to the defender's bravery. Say, we're not questioning your bravery, etc., but this is your rightful king, or you have no chance of relief. Surrender and we'll let you go, essentially. Yeah. So ask nicely, yes.
Yeah. So, okay, so if that method fails, if the castle defenders aren't too keen on surrendering, and we've moved slightly forward in time, so we're now no longer talking about wooden castles which could easily be attacked by fire, we're talking about stone keeps, what then would you do if you did want to try and take a stone keep?
Well, I suppose it depends on how much of a hurry you're in.
Mm.
If you're in a hurry, the easiest thing to do, or not the easiest, but the simplest thing to do would be to try a surprise attack. So essentially turn up at night with some ladders, try and get over the walls of the castle or keep in that way, or nip in through the door if it's not closed. And it sounds bizarre, but this happened on more than one occasion. The Scots were particularly adept at this in the time of Robert Bruce, mainly because they didn't really have any siege engines, you know, large catapults and what have you.
Sure.
So they did things like pushing cartloads of hay through castle gates with men hiding under, the real Robin Hood stuff, in fact, to jam the doors open, or sneaking up at night covered in blankets, with the result that the defenders mistook them for a herd of cattle. These things actually took place. So a sneak attack could work. Obviously, if you've summoned a castle to surrender, a sneak attack isn't going to work because the defenders are going to know that something's afoot. And in those circumstances, you have to go for something more of a formal siege. Now, there are various ways that this could be done, I suppose. You could bash the walls down. You could go over the walls, if not with ladders, with the belfries or giant siege towers of the medieval period. In other words, essentially big towers on wheels which overlook the walls so that people could shoot in. Or had drawbridges so that the soldiers sheltering within the tower could swarm over the battlements. So that was one way of doing it. But more often than not, the surest way of getting into to a keep was to undermine it.
Yep.
So essentially you dug a tunnel or a hole underneath a corner of the keep wall. You prop that up then, it's a bit like the Great Escape really, with wooden pit props or whatever you could find. You then piled a load of combustible material in that cavity, and then when you felt the time is right, you set a light to the combustible material, the props burnt through, and the wall came crashing down. This, of course, was not without its problems, because having done that, you ended up with a huge repair bill.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've gone through this effort of capturing a keep, let's say Rochester, for example, which this is what happened at Rochester during the reign of King John. And afterwards, one corner of the keep had to be totally rebuilt. So it wasn't unknown for the attackers to do all of their work, undermine the tower, and then invite a representative of the defenders to come out and have a look and see what they've done.
That's fantastic, isn't it? So yeah, do we have records of that? What would the defenders say when they saw that?
Well, they would have a choice.
Yeah.
During the Crusades and the later period of the Crusades, the Sultan Baybars, who was a great exponent of siege warfare, did this to the Crusaders on a number of occasions. The English did it to the French during the Hundred Years' War.
Yeah.
And essentially, it was that they were then given a choice. You know, well, look, you can see what's going to happen here. If you surrender now, we'll let you go or we'll spare your lives or whatever they felt like offering the defenders. If, on the other hand, you force us to bring down the wall and launch an attack, your lives are forfeit, mate.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a pretty effective way of taking a castle, then.
It's a pretty surefire way.
Yeah.
If you've got the right grounds. So castles like, for example, Dover, which are built on chalk, are somewhat vulnerable to undermining. But it doesn't mean that the defenders sort of sat in there and waited for the inevitable, though. There's always things that they could do to counter it. They might dig a camouflet, which was a countermine of their own, and break into the attacker's mine, and then you'd end up with a sort of horrific fight in the dark with spades and pickaxes up underground. Or they might lay out bowls of water at regular intervals around the walls, and the reason why they would do this is they could then determine where the undermining was taking place. The ripples from the attacker's picks underground would obviously be most marked where that was taking place, and therefore the defenders could prepare.
Yeah.
And, for example, they might, as during the Albigensian Crusades, the Cathars at Carcassonne built a second wall inside the main wall that was going to come down. Or at Dover, during the siege of 1216, the defenders built a barricade out of wood on the inside of the tower that they knew was going to come down.
Sure.
So you could bring down the wall, but you still then had to, if you're an attacker, probably launch an attack.
Yeah.
And there's no guarantee it was going to succeed.
Hmm. So undermining would have been just as effective in terms of bringing the walls down against a 12th century keep as it would have been against the more advanced 13th century sort of concentric ring type castle. So, I mean, it would still bring down the walls, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
Yeah. So did castle attackers have to get even more sophisticated as castle defence technology developed?
Yes, I mean, to make a sort of rather obvious comparison, you've got a kind of arms race going on, really, that improvements in assault techniques required the defenders of castles to come up with something a little bit more imaginative, perhaps, to counter them. And the trouble with keeps was that, to all intents and purposes, if you were defending a keep, what you did was that you went inside, you locked the door, and there wasn't much more you could do. You might be able to drop objects from the battlements or shoot out of the various apertures in the walls, although more often than not they were to let in light rather than to shoot out of.
But so really you were just sat there hoping the defenders, the attackers would go away?
Yeah, either they went away or that you had a relieving army somewhere in the area that might come along and help you. But it was what you might call a passive defence.
Yeah.
With the concentric castles, which are coming really from the reign of Edward I, so we're talking about, you know, the second half of the 13th century.
Yeah.
You've got a situation where the defenders have got more opportunities to strike back. Broadly speaking, a concentric castle, what you're doing is that you're putting the emphasis of the defence away from the keep in the centre and further out into the walls. And you might have you would have more than one set of walls. So places like Beaumaris in Wales and Dover, and indeed the Tower of London show this, where you've got a succession of walls, which meant that the attackers could be engaged from more than one place at once. And having got through the first wall, they were then in a rather narrow killing zone with a second wall to deal with. You'd also have a lot more emphasis placed on the gatehouse.
Right.
And the gatehouse became like the centre of the defence of the castle. And they became good examples of this, I suppose, are the Constable's Gate at Dover or the gate at Carisbrook on the Isle of Wight. And, in fact, the original gate to the Tower of London, where you had a whole succession of defences, so that the gatehouse became almost a castle in itself.
Hmm.
And what this did was, it increased the obstacles that the attacker had to deal with, but also it kept him further away.
Yeah.
So therefore, he couldn't bring up his various siege engines to close range,
and
sort of bombard something in an attempt to bring it to surrender. He was forced further and further back.
Yeah, okay. But as you said, one of the key aims of someone attacking a castle would probably to be able to try and keep it in order. So if they didn't want to destroy the walls, if they didn't want to have to throw rocks at it, burn it, or undermine the walls, what else could they resort to get those defenders out of the castle if diplomacy had failed and they didn't want to just smash the walls in?
Well, ultimately, the commonest way that if the castle fell was for somebody on the inside to let you in.
Now,
you could try treachery, bribery. You could offer the defenders positions, money, whatever it might be to get them to surrender. So the Scots, for example, when they attacked Carlisle Castle, William the Lion attacking in the 1170s, he offered the Constable of Carlisle Castle a choice of gold and silver if he surrendered and a bad death if he didn't.
Yep, fair
enough. So that was one thing you could do. But more often than not, the main thing that happened was that the attackers would simply surround the castle, make themselves as comfortable as they could, and wait for starvation and or sickness to take effect.
Hmm. Which in itself was a fairly risky policy, because you could be attacked by the relieving force coming up behind you.
Yes, I mean, this was the problem with this approach, that A, there was a great possibility that a relieving force would come along and attack you, and as a result you find that around many castles you ended up with siege works, castles of their own built by attackers. Corfe Castle in Dorset, you can still see, I think they're called the Rings, which date back to the anarchy of Stephen and Matilda, which was where the besieging force were based. So you've got that problem. Also, you've got to supply your army, and if you're sitting there for maybe 3, 4, 5 months at a time, doing nothing, it could be quite expensive and indeed quite difficult. So we still got, for example, the accounts of the siege of Kenilworth in the 1260s, where Henry III had to go to all sorts of lengths to keep his army supplied. You've got the royal forest being denuded of deer and stags to feed his household. You've even got the Sheriff of London sending up what's described as a whale for the attackers to eat. So you had that difficulty, and it could be worse if you were operating in hostile territory. So good example of this are the Crusaders during the Third Crusade, when they were laying siege to Acre. They were, in a sense, besieged while they were laying siege to Acre. So there was rampant inflation in the crusading camp, and the smallest amounts of food meant for the hugest amounts of money.
Yeah.
And, of course, if you were laying siege to a castle and you had specialists in your army, because, you know, you could rely on your feudal levies and on your immediate households, I suppose, if you were a besieger, you know, you needed specialist engineers, you needed specialist troops, you might need specialist artillerymen, for example. You had to pay them.
Hmm.
So that was another problem. It could become quite expensive.
Yeah. So I suppose as developments in artillery and gunpowder progressed towards the end of the medieval period, it became less and less tenable that anyone would actually ever be able to hold out in a siege situation for that long. So when do castles start to lose their status as defensive places?
Well, they always, of course, had more than one status. I mean, obviously, we're talking here about castles as bastions, I suppose, as places of war, but they were always a lot more than that. So they were residences, they were status symbols, they were prisons, they were storehouses, they were administrative centres, and so on and so on. And so they never lost their importance in that way through the medieval period. But by the 15th century, with the onset of gunpowder artillery, from a military point of view, all things being equal, a castle's days were numbered, because a high stone wall was not proof against gunpowder artillery.
Yeah.
However, having said that, there wasn't a lot of it about. And the great sort of guns of, for example, the Wars of the Roses period were so rare, in fact, that they all had their own names. So Edward IV's siege train that he used after the Battle of Towton in the 1460s, all the great sort of iron and bronze guns he had, they had their own names. There was Dijon, and there was Newcastle, and there was one, I think, that was called Richard Bombardel, which is quite a good name for a gun, because it does exactly what it says on the name. But these were expensive to manufacture. They were terribly difficult to transport, these things. And so there were a lot more castles, really, than there were guns. But if an attacker was determined enough and had the resources and he had the logistical arrangements to get those guns into position, a castle was in a little bit of a difficult situation then. But we come back to that question of, do the attackers want a damaged castle?
Yeah.
You could easily blow a castle to smithereens once you've got your artillery in place. But that's not much good if you want to use it yourself at a later date. And I suppose the great example of this is the first English castle to fall through bombardment, which was Bamburgh Castle, which was one of the last Lancastrian strongholds during the middle period of the Wars of the Roses, so we're talking about 1464, where the Nevilles, Warwick and Montague, in fact, fighting for Edward IV, brought the Yorkist siege train up to Bamburgh and were in a position to bombard the castle. But the problem with that was that Bamburgh was an important royal castle. It was an administrative centre, and it was also an important base against the Scots, who weren't that much further up the road, as it were. And they really didn't want to have to destroy it. And in fact, that the Neville sent a herald into the castle saying that, you know, this is a jewel, this castle, and we wish to preserve it because of its proximity to the border. And for every cannonball that you force us to fire at the walls, a head will be removed when we capture it.
Oh, right, gruesome.
Yeah. In the event, actually, the castle was surrendered because it was badly damaged, but a falling piece of masonry hit the garrison commander on the head, and whilst he was incapacitated, somebody else took the opportunity to surrender.
I see. Well, Julian, many thanks for that
you're welcome.
Fascinating insight into capturing castles. And it's a rather more nuanced subject than perhaps we might think of just throwing rocks or trying to burn it down.
Indeed.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Enemies at the Gate, English Castles Under Siege from the 12th Century to the Civil War by Julian Humphreys is published by English Heritage. Now that's castles dealt with. Before we move on to Max Hastings, Sue and Rob, let's have that second festive
cracker.
Sue.
Okay, no cheating.
Gotcha. Oh, what was that?
He cheated.
He did. There was a prize there.
We've got some cards. There you go, Sue.
What did the beaver say to the tree?
Is this rude?
What did the beaver... I don't know. My what small teeth you've got.
Chop, like, chop.
I don't know.
Nice gnawing you.
Just awful. That's worse than my one.
That's just awful, isn't it? And now we move over to the War of the Pacific, and let's hear what Max Hastings had to say when he spoke to Rob Atter.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Are you hoping to overturn some popular misconceptions with this book?
I think it is chiefly a business of perspective. When I pick up a book that announces that there are huge, big new revelations about the Second World War, I know that it's overwhelmingly likely that I'm not going to believe what's in it, because there aren't many big revelations. What you can try and do is improve our perspective on events to try and see things in better perspective.
So what were the biggest surprises for you in your research?
I'm always interested in exploring people's cultures. And, of course, here you're talking about the cultures of many different nations. I mean, I was absolutely fascinated. One day I was talking to a Japanese fighter pilot who was describing their last battles in the summer of 1945, which for them were very like the Battle of Britain for the pilots of fighter command. They lay around on the grass at their bases in Japan, waiting until they were scrambled, and then they had this terrific struggle to try and get up to altitude and engage these huge American B-29s, very often without much success. But I said to this old Japanese pilot, I said, what did you do on the ground while you were waiting to be called to action? And he said, oh, we played a lot of bridge. I said, bridge? And he said, oh, yes. He said, we were Navy, and the Japanese Navy prided itself on following closely the British cultural tradition. So bridge was a big thing for us. And he said, we played for pretty high stakes because we didn't think that we were likely to be around to spend the money. And I was absolutely riveted by this portrait of these would-be kamikazes sitting around calling two clubs, three spades, in between fighting these terrible battles with this enormous American Air Force overhead.
And something in the book that interested me was when you talked about the Australian war effort.
Yeah.
And how that seemed to just fall apart.
Well, it was a mystery to me. It was something I knew nothing at all about till I started to research it, that all I knew about Australia in the war was, first of all, Australia produced some terrific pilots. Secondly, the Australian Army had done brilliantly well in North Africa and in New Guinea in 1942-43. But from 1943 onwards, the Australian Army, for a variety of reasons which I explain, sort of more or less found itself relegated to a humiliating back seat. And this was a mixture of forces. First of all, in the last stages of the war, MacArthur didn't really want anybody else in his American crusade to liberate the Philippines and defeat Japan. But secondly, the dissensions inside Australia about the war and the political dissensions. I mean, you had all these extraordinary, the dock strikes, the dock workers' unions, which were communist-dominated, behaved appallingly. The deployment of the British fleet in the Far East was seriously delayed, that there were the American official histories report the frightful difficulties of unloading supplies in Australian docks. In the end, they had to use a lot of American troops to offload supplies because the Australian dock workers behaved so appallingly. There were bad strikes in the mines. It was an Australian newspaper that said towards the end of 1944 that this country is degenerating into something close to civil war politically. And it was a hell of a political mess. You had a very weak Labour government led by John Curtin. And a lot of Australian soldiers had only volunteered for home service, and they wouldn't volunteer for overseas service. So, for example, you got probably the best fighting division on the Allied side in the Second World War was the 9th Australian Division, which fought in the Western Desert. But they were all volunteers. And by 1943, you got half the Australian Army, the so-called militia, who'd refused to volunteer for overseas service. You've got two or three Australian divisions of volunteers fighting in New Guinea, but you've got hundreds of thousands of Australian troops sitting about in Australia doing absolutely nothing. And in the last phase of the war, they found themselves relegated to mopping up on the islands after relieving American troops who'd gone on to invade the Philippines and so on. And Australia's experience in the last 2 years of the war was very unhappy and contributed very little militarily. And again, I hadn't understood this at all until I started to write the book. And it's a sad story because the Australian contribution in the first half of the war had been so sensational.
And it's strange because obviously Japan was targeting Australia at one point. It wasn't...
Absolutely. Well, this, of course, was what changed the Australian perspective, that when the Japanese started to sweep across the Pacific in December 41 and early 42, that, first of all, the Australian government and most Australian people were very bitter about the failure of the British to defend them, that the deal had always been supposed to be of empire. They supported the home country in its faraway wars, but in return the home country defended their interests when they were threatened. And now suddenly Singapore and Malaya fells, and entire Australian division goes down the tube in Singapore, and the Australian government panicked. And first of all, they insisted on the recall of all their troops from North Africa and elsewhere. And Churchill pleaded with them and begged with them to be allowed to keep at least some. But the Australians insisted on their entire army being returned to Australia. And although it was actually a very short period of time in early 1942 when a Japanese invasion of Australia looked remotely credible, that the fact remained that thereafter the Australians were very unwilling to let their troops, in fact they flatly refused to allow their troops fight anywhere other than in campaigns immediately around Australia. In other words, Australian troops fought with great distinction in New Guinea in 1942-43, before the Americans came on the scene. But Churchill begged in 1944 for some Australian troops to help in Burma, and the Australian government wouldn't have it at any price. And it's a very bitter story, and there was bitterness on both sides. There's no doubt the British government handled the Australian government insensitively, that Churchill really regarded the empire above all as a source of manpower, and he was very unwilling to give either the Australian government or the Canadian government a serious voice in decision-making about the war. And especially he liked Robert Menzies, the Prime Minister in the first half of the war, but after Menzies was succeeded by Curtin, the Labour Prime Minister, that Churchill had some enclosed contempt for Curtin's government, wouldn't take them seriously and showed it. And of course, this increased the bitterness down there in Canberra.
And how do you think the defeat of Japan compares to that of Germany, which you wrote about in Armageddon?
Again, one reason I like writing books is that one always learns so much oneself in the course of writing them. And what you come to realise is, really, we all confuse ourselves by calling the Second World War the Second World War. We should call it the Second World Wars in the plural, because the war in Asia was so utterly different from the war in Europe. and Japan was pursuing utterly different objectives from those of Germany. And really, what's amazing is the degree to which the Japanese and the Germans, although they were supposedly allied to each other, took incredibly little interest in what each other were doing. And even in the West, what's striking is that among the Western allies, Churchill and Roosevelt and their chiefs of staff were the only people who treated the European and Asian wars as a common cause. Everybody else who was involved, if you were fighting in Burma or on Okinawa, what was happening in Europe seemed fantastically remote. You hardly thought about it, and vice versa. They were two very, very different wars. The whole mood of the wars was different, and I found it enormously rewarding writing about it. And I would like to think that what one's tried to do is to paint a portrait of this huge experience rather than merely run through a narrative, a lot of which is familiar. Well, I would like to hope that it will tell readers things that they hadn't thought about before about the Second World War.
Because I suppose the war in Japan is far less well-known, certainly in Britain, than it is, than the war against Germany is.
Well, I think that's obviously because in the first instance it's more remote, but I would like to think that readers in Europe, now that Asia is becoming so critical in our world, and now that we can all see how vital China is becoming to the future of the globe, you can't understand what China is today without understanding where China came from in the Second World War, that the whole politics of Asia to this very day are dominated by passionate Chinese hatred of the Japanese for what they did in China in the Second World War and for their absolute refusal to apologize for it. And this is still a huge factor in Chinese politics. And if one wants to understand what Asia is today, you've got to know what happened in the 1930s and 1940s. And I would like to think that whereas a generation ago, yes, people were much more interested in the war in Europe, today Asia looms so large that I think there is a much bigger public out there than there used to be for learning about the Asian War.
Max Hastings' Nemesis, The Battle for Japan, 1944-45, is published by Harper Press. So thanks for that, Rob. Finally, let's go back in time a little further and find out what I discovered when I was privileged to go deep inside the enigmatic Neolithic monument, Silbury Hill. And we're going to hear what the English heritage archaeologist Jim Leary, who's leading the project in Silbury Hill, has to say about that curious place.
Right, if you just sort of could come in as far as you can, and I'll just talk to you here. We're now right in the centre of the hill. We're looking at the very primary mound, effectively the genesis that later became Silbury as we know it. This is the very first construction, and it's a 5 metre high mound of earth and turfs, literally turfs that have been sods of ground that have been cut and piled up, and a mixture of chalk and some clay and some gravel. And so this is what we're looking at, just these, all these different colours are just layers of presumably just basket loads of what looked like riverine muds, some chalk, clay, and these rather remarkable black patches are turfs of ground that would have had, you can see the black line across the top is where the grass would have been growing. So this primary mound was very rapidly encased in chalk, and what that's done is preserved organic remains that we don't normally get from this period, from any period really, but particularly from this period, and we don't get them preserved as well as they've been preserved here. The preservation is phenomenal. From this sequence here, we have insects, we have ants that have been preserved, we have beetles, wing cases, and that's just the tiny samples that we've processed. We still have a long way to go. On the top of the old ground surface, there's a black line of organics, which is actually made up of grass and moss. And we've processed some of that, and the grass is still green and still intact. And the moss looks like somebody picked it up the other day. The preservation is absolutely phenomenal. And for this type of landscape, in this period, that makes it unique.
So how, you said it was rapidly encased by chalk. What do you mean by rapid?
Well, we have started a redating programme for Silbury Hill using a number of our radiocarbon samples. Not everything has been dated that we will date. But the initial samples show that the primary mound was constructed at 2400 BC or a generation either side of that. So we have a very, very tight date for the primary mound. The secondary mound Interestingly, the Silbury II, the chalk mound, comes out as 2400 BC or a generation either side of that as well.
Okay.
And that's based on antler fragments that we recovered from Silbury II. So it shows that Silbury I and II must have been a pretty rapid process, at least perhaps over a couple of generations. Silbury III, we have two models. Model 2 suggests that it's also a rapid process at 2400 BC. Model 1, which I prefer, has Silbury III as a later construct, centred around about 2000, so a few hundred years later. And that's the model I prefer at the moment. More dating needs to be done and will be done, and that will iron out, you know, which models are the correct ones. But my reason for thinking that Silbury III is later is the grass that we recovered from the top of Silbury II. It shows that there was at least a standstill. That doesn't need to be particularly long, admittedly, but it does show that it was a standstill. I have to say that the sense that I get from looking at all the phases of Silbury Hill suggests that it's a monument in action, in progress. No one ever sets out to construct it of a certain shape or size. It just grows and expands. And I have a feeling that the construction of Silbury Hill is probably as important to the builders as the final monument. And I think that we get the same from looking at stone circles and timber circles. They always seem to be moving. Posts come out, posts get redug, put in new places. The blue stones at Stonehenge get pulled out, moved around, put in. And it gives us a sense that they're not trying to create a final product. So they weren't trying to create a final mound, Silbury Hill. It was the building of it. It was the act of doing it. That was what's important. And another important aspect of the turfs that we've analysed from this section of the primary mound, they don't seem to have come from this soil horizon. So logically, you would say, we know that the soils have been, the turfs have been stripped from under Silbury 2 and 3, or under Silbury 2. Logically, you'd think, well, that probably stripped it and piled it up over, you know, to form Silbury 1. Well, that doesn't seem to be the case. These turfs seem to have come from elsewhere, from a calcareous soil. So it suggests that people are bringing turfs in and soil in. A lot of the soil in here, it seems to be riverine, and the gravel is riverine. So perhaps they're bringing it from the river. It gives us a nice association with that river and the Swallowhead Springs, which is very nearby. So it sort of suggests that this mound is bound up with water, with springs, and people are bringing turfs of ground with them. Why, we don't know. We still need to work out where exactly these turfs have come from in the landscape. But it could be that communities are coming from far and wide to Silbury Hill, and as they're coming, they're bringing a little patch of their ground with them. We don't know.
So am I right in thinking that the basic system is we had the ground surface, which was deturfed, and then there were a lot of people wandering around it for a length of time, and then they started building Silbury 1, which is basically riverine mud and some turf, and a fairly small mound?
It's a small mound. They start off with a gravel core, and then they pile mud and turfs over the top of that, and that is around about a 5 metre high mound, 35 metre diameter mound.
And that's Silbury 1?
And that's Silbury 1.
Okay, and then Silbury 2, that's just chalk just put on top of, just basically just dumped on top of it?
Dumped on top.
No structural elements as far as you can see?
As far as we can see, no. I mean, it seems as if they've basically created a large bank around Silbury 1 and then infilled on top of the bank. That seems to be the construction technique, looking at the tip lines. So, yeah, we can have a look at, when we go into the East Latch, we can have a look at that interface between Silbury 1 and Silbury 2.
And then Silbury 2, that grassed over briefly, and then Silbury 3...
Silbury 2 seems to be a 25-metre high mound, and that's grassed over. So there's a standstill period, and then we get renewed activity again, and that's the final construct, Silbury 3. Yep.
Which is what we see today, yep.
And that was Dave with a rare look inside Silbury Hill to wrap up this month's podcast. We hope you've enjoyed listening, and please do make sure you check out the magazine for more on all the topics you've been hearing about. We've also got a special extra Christmas quiz podcast coming up to keep you entertained over the festive period. That's going to be ready to download from the 10th of December. Well, that's about it from us. We hope you all have a great Christmas, and we'll be back with lots more for you in 2008. But for now, goodbye.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.